is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests. And today we have with us Diane Massey from Be Alive. And Be Alive is an interesting product. I've taken it for 8 or 9 years, and I'm 74 years old. I think it's a great, great product. And so I wanted Diane to, of course, share with you this morning some of her thoughts on it. You've been working for Be Alive for quite some time, haven't you, Diane?
I have, actually, Dr. Stan. Be Alive's been in business for almost 19 years, and I've been with them for 12.
All right, fine. Well, what is Be Alive? What's the advantage of the product? I know, but why don't you tell our listeners?
Well, Be Alive, as you were saying, we are a Christian health food company. And we started almost 19 years ago, not because we wanted to start a business, but because a natural substance from the beehive so much changed our president's life that she decided that she wanted to help people feel better with more energy, stamina, and vitality, because she was very run down and very tired, and this product really did it for her. And, you know, Dr. Stan, we've now been in business 19 years. We have people calling us left and right saying that either some people are tired in the middle of the day, other people are tired when they wake up in the morning, they feel like they already did a whole day's work, and our product has been a real blessing to so many.
Well, I know it has, and certainly my wife and I have both taken it for a number of years, so we're very, very happy with it. Well, basically, what is Be Alive Royal Jelly? Where does it come from? How does it work? And, of course, why does it make people feel better? It really gives them more in the way of energy, doesn't it?
It does, really, energy, stamina, and vitality. But I like to tell people, not energy like you would get from caffeine or ephedra. Those are unhealthy energy sources. Royal jelly gives you a healthy energy. Royal jelly is actually the food of the queen bee. It comes from the beehive, and many people think it's a jelly or a jam, but it's not even sweet at all to the taste. It's actually like a white custardy substance. And I think it's probably one of the most remarkable substances that God has ever created in nature, because it's responsible for creating a queen bee. She's not born to be a queen. She only turns into a queen by the food that she eats. If you took female baby bees in a beehive and you took one of them and fed her honey and pollen, Dr. Stan, she would develop into a very industrious worker bee, and she'd live up to 6 weeks. But if you took the exact same female baby bee and you fed her royal jelly, she would then develop into a queen bee, and she'd live up to 6 years. So it's quite a remarkable substance.
And, of course, it's really made by the bees, and, of course, there's some way you have of tricking the bees into actually giving it to you, because they don't ordinarily make much in the hive. How do you actually trick them into producing the royal jelly that you're able to market?
Well, bees will actually produce royal jelly consistently for the queen. And what we do is we have actual beehives that, if you were to look at a natural domestic hive, all of the shapes of the cells are the same. They're six-sided. But in a domestic hive, you'd find one elongated cell, and that is a signal for the worker bee to make royal jelly for the queen. So what we do is we create cell boards that have many elongated cells, and therefore they create a lot of royal jelly. But it's still, as much as they create it, it is still a very rare and precious substance, because you only get half of a thumbnail's worth out of every beehive. Every domestic beehive. So it is quite rare and very precious. And the reason, I believe, you said earlier, why does it really work and give us the energy, stamina, and vitality? Scientists have broken down this substance called royal jelly, and what they have found is that it contains many nutritious bioactive compounds, like trace amounts of B complex vitamins, minerals like calcium, magnesium, potassium, and zinc, acetylcholine, very important, amino acids, which are building blocks of protein, lipids, phospholipids, fatty acids, all rolled into a food substance synergistically put together by God. So I say to people, you know, we can't take any credit for royal jelly. God created the bees who make this wonderful substance, and all we do is he's entrusted it to us help his children with it.
And this, of course, has been really used for many years, hasn't it, or many centuries by people in very, people with a lot of money, because it's pretty hard for the average person, at least prior to your marketing effort, it wasn't used very widely, was it?
No, actually, it's been used by decades by Asians and Europeans, but usually for the elite and royalty. Like you're saying, it wasn't something that was for the masses. But we've spent the last 19 years packaging it in a way that we feel it's affordable for people, and they can all benefit from it. It's a gift from God that He's placed in nature, and we just harvest it and give it to His children. Because our goal at Be Alive is to help His children live in optimum health, and that means energy, stamina, vitality, and feeling good every single day.
Well, now, how long does it take before this really has an effect? You say it doesn't act like ephedra or these coffee or the things that give you the immediate boost. How long does it take for the Be Alive Royal Jelly to really have an impact on people?
Well, Dr. Stan, I like to tell people, whenever you take a natural supplement, you want to give it some time to work in the body. It's not a quick fix. So if you take Royal Jelly on a daily basis, everyone sees a difference, and I can't tell you why, because I don't quite know, but everyone sees a difference in a different amount of time. Some people will tell you in 2 weeks, wow, they really see a difference. Other people might say it took a month, and some might say it took 2 months. But within 3 months, usually, everyone sees a tremendous difference, and that's why we sell our Royal Jelly in a 3-month supply, because it's important to be sure that people see the benefit.
All right, fine. So it takes a good while before it really does begin to, or it may take a fair length of time before it really impacts on the individual. Now, of course, Madeline Belletta, she was really laid up. Why don't you tell the story of how you found out about this, how Madeline Belletta, who is actually the founder of Be Alive,
yes,
actually found out about the product and decided, once it had helped her, to try to get it available for others.
Well, Madeline was a young mom. She was in her early 30s. She had 2 children. And she just felt like there was a period of her life where she was so darn tired, just so tired, sometimes so fatigued and exhausted. And it got to a point where her mother-in-law and her mother had to come and take the kids on the weekend just to give her a break. And she had tried, Dr. Stan, everything. Anyone told her she tried. Well, a dear sister in church one day told her that she felt she should try Royal Jelly. She felt it would really help her. Madeline began to take it, and little by little, as I told you, it wasn't overnight, but little by little, she really started to feel herself again and had the energy to keep up with the kids, to keep up with her husband, to do her housework, and to really enjoy life again. And when she saw what it was like, that a natural substance can play a role in how we feel every day, she really prayed. And God told her, she felt God gave her a vision and a mission to start Be Alive so that we could help His children with this wonderful substance to live in optimum health. And she started Be Alive for that reason, not because she was looking to start a business, but because she felt she had a product that God wanted her to share with others. So it really is it's quite remarkable.
All right, fine. And of course, you've been around for 19 years, so the product must be fairly effective, and of course, I can attest to the fact that I wouldn't be without it. We did try going without it one time, and wasn't very long before we went back again.
So many people tell us that.
And so we've used it, and you really have people all across the country really using this now, don't you, on a regular
basis? We have hundreds of thousands of people who use this product, and I'll give you an example of how it helped me. I was a person, I had 4 children, and my second child, Deirdre, is profoundly handicapped. Well, we did a therapy program with Deirdre called Patterning, and I had 100 volunteers coming into my home every week, Dr. Stan, 2 by 2 every hour. And they worked with me from 9 in the morning till 6 at night, 7 days a week for 6 years. And going through that, I was a little tired. I would get a little run down. And what would happen to me is every day for 6 years, I felt like I, at 3 o'clock, had to stop therapy for half an hour and take a nap, or I just couldn't go on anymore. It was really devastating. And I just kind of felt, this is the way God made my body. It's the way I have to deal with it. And when I met Madeline, she said to me, Diane, you need to try the Royal Jelly. And Dr. Stan, I really didn't believe it would help me, if I can be very truthful. I tried it because I liked Madeline, and I just wanted to do it for her. Within 4 weeks, no lie, this happened for 6 years of my life. Every day at 3 o'clock, I had to take a nap. Within 4 weeks, I no longer was tired at 3 o'clock. It was like any other hour of the day. I had energy, stamina, vitality, and I was amazed that anything that we can take from nature like this that can have such a profound effect on someone could really help them feel more alive. You know, I say to people, I was the kind of person that after work, I would go home, and with four children, you feed them dinner, you do the homework, and by 8:30, you're falling asleep on the couch. I remember after 4 weeks of taking my royal jelly, it was about 10:30 at night, and I was washing clothes, and my husband Dan said, "Guy, what are you doing?" And I said, "I just feel good enough to do it." So it's like an energy extender for your day, I tell people, but what I love about it is that it's healthy energy. You know, so many people can tell us about natural products like ephedra, mawang, guarana, all you can get in the health food store, but they are stimulants to the body. Royal jelly is a healthy energy. It is not a stimulant, and it's a wonderful, wonderful gift from God.
Well, of course, could you just put out your telephone number so people would know how to get in touch with you?
Absolutely. You know, we don't sell our royal jelly in health food stores. You can only get it through calling Be Alive. And the toll-free number is 1-866-233-7500. And if you just want any more information about Be Alive or about our royal jelly, they would give you more information.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much for being with us today. Our guest has been Diane Massey. We've been talking about Be Alive royal jelly products. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Stan, and stay healthy.
I will. Bye-bye. Well, anyway, this is... Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, we just wanted to have you hear Diane and learn a little bit about this product. I've taken it for 9 years, my wife has as well, and we think it's a great, great product. Well, we're going to have a little different program this evening. We're going to be talking now for about 15 minutes about the trade with Communist China, and of course, how the Wall Street Journal, and there's an article here on Tuesday, August 19th, that's today, in the Wall Street Journal, about trade with China, sort of poo-pooing that anybody should be concerned about trade with Communist China, and of course pointing out all the great advantages we have of our trade, and pointing out, of course, you know, we do have a little trade deficit with China, about $103 billion this year, pointing out that we're really doing great. I mean, they have $103 billion more of trade than we have, but look at all the trade we have with them. Why we're selling them $6.9 billion worth of material. In fact, that's up 37% in the last 4 years, and it includes, we're selling them civilian aircraft, semiconductors, industrial machines, and telecom equipment, etc. Well, of course, those industrial machines will soon be used to produce products to compete with our own products. And, of course, the Chinese are flooding the United States with their products. In fact, they're flooding the world with their products. And what you must understand is the Wall Street Journal is simply an extension of this Brotherhood of Darkness that I talk about. It's owned by the same forces that control the New York Times and the Washington Post and Time and Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report and ABC, CBS, and NBC, which we put on the left. And on the right, we have, of course, the Wall Street Journal, Reader's Digest, the American Spectator, the New American Standard, National Review. Those are supposedly the publications on the right. And ladies and gentlemen, they are all controlled by the same forces that have an agenda. And that is to convince us, of course, that globalization is the path to prosperity. Well, it may be the path to prosperity for the Chinese. It may be the path to prosperity for the South Koreans and the Malaysians, but it's the path to poverty for America. Because associated with what we're seeing as the export of American jobs, never to return again. According to this article, it says, well, to be sure, China's export growth is still going to cost some Americans their current jobs, and no one should make light of the painful adjustment. But other American jobs are being created by the rapid growth in U.S. exports to China, more than 15% growth in the past couple of years, albeit from a low, low base. Well, you have to understand that the new jobs that are being created are flipping hamburgers and certainly janitor jobs, but these are not jobs that are good-paying jobs. Our good-paying jobs are being intentionally shipped offshore because there is an agenda. It's called wealth redistribution. our wealth is being redistributed throughout the world, but they can't tell the American people. The real purpose behind this is that age-old concept of from each according to their ability to each according to their need. And if the American people understood that our leaders do not have loyalty to America, but to this globalist Marxist dream, why, if the American people knew that, they'd rise up and throw out the leaders of both political parties. But, of course, that's not to be the case. As Professor Quigley says so well in his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, and Professor Quigley was Bill Clinton's mentor, and if you haven't read the book, you need to get it. The book was so good that no sooner was it published in 1966 than somebody bought up the publisher, Macmillan, and destroyed the place to the first half of the book so it could not be republished. And we have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells that story. And, of course, for many years the book was totally unavailable because on pages 1247 and 1248 he lays it out very clearly. The whole idea is to have two political parties that are essentially the same. And, of course, you will actually, let the people go to the polls every 4 years and throw the rascals out. But the foreign and domestic policies remain the same. That's what it's really all about. And the real objective of our leaders today is globalization, whether it be the Democrats or the Republicans. And this whole idea of then redistributing the wealth, sending our factories overseas. Now what they're pointing out is that there's about $50 billion being invested in communist China every year from outside. About 10% of that comes from America, and I think it's probably much more than that. But it's saying, it's so wonderful because our factories over there, of course, are making money, and then that's benefiting us back at home. So we invest $5 billion a year over there, and then the profit from those factories comes home. And if you really believe that, you're incredibly gullible. Because the way the tax laws are written, we punish the companies for bringing the money back here. The whole idea is to export our industries and then, of course, to keep those profits overseas to buy more industries, to build up the economy of third world countries, to improve the living standards of people throughout the world as we progressively but incrementally lower the standards of the American people. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, want to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. The article starts out, and this is on the editorial page, page A8, and you really want to read it to understand what sophistry is all about, how you can lie through your teeth. And, of course, the average individual is not sophisticated enough to realize that you're really lying to them. Trade with China is becoming a hot topic as U.S. politicians in both parties deplore a $103 billion bilateral trade deficit that's growing by about 25% a year. Now, what they're saying is that we buy $103 billion more from communist China than we sell communist China. How much do we sell communist China? $6.9 billion. How much do we import from them? About $110 billion. And their deficit with us is growing 25% a year. In other words, they're getting 25% more every year. And if it continues at this way, why next year, why there'll be a $125 billion deficit. And so what's communist China doing with all that money? Well, it doesn't do any good to have it sitting, in a mattress over there somewhere in Beijing. They're coming over and buying up major American corporations, even many of our high-tech corporations, and simply moving them lock, stock, and barrel to communist China. So that many of the components of our sophisticated weapons, such as the guided weaponry, the cruise missiles, the guided bombs, it all comes from communist China. We're really totally dependent upon communist China to maintain our own military, while communist China is working full-time to build up theirs in preparation for the coming war with the United States. And if you read this book, Hegemony, by a friend of mine, Stephen Moser, from the Population Control Institute, Population Research Institute, you will find out that communist China, in the writings, is talking about the coming war with America. We're creating the best enemy money could buy, as we did, of course, with the Japanese in the Second World War, with the Chinese pardon me, with the Germans during the Second World War, as we did with Saddam Hussein, who we financed right up in the very time of the war with Kuwait. We'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're just talking about how you can write these glowing articles about, oh, how wonderful these ideas of globalization are, and really how all these markets we're going to have over in communist China. Why, you don't believe we are going to have markets and we're going to be able to sell tremendous amounts of material over there and make lots of good jobs here in the United States. Why, of course, you must either be some sort of a right-wing fanatic, or you have at least two brain cells still functioning in your head. Because, I mean, certainly there's got to be great markets in China, but do you think they're going to buy American goods? We were promised that there would be these great markets in Mexico if we just go along with NAFTA. We had a positive trade balance with Mexico before NAFTA. Once, of course, we went into NAFTA, took down our trade barriers, why we had a negative trade balance. And, of course, that we shifted our factories to Mexico. And, of course, we shifted our jobs to Mexico. And Mexico has prospered. And Detroit now looks like a disaster area where we used to produce so many of our cars. Why, those cars are produced south of the border today. And more of our companies are closing down. Canon, the largest maker of towels and sheets, and most of you have slept in Canon sheets and dried yourself with Canon towels, and Canon simply is folding up, closing down its 14 or 15 mills, laying off thousands and thousands of workers here in the United States. Why? Because, of course, of the flood of products that are coming in from communist China and Southeast Asia as redistribute the wealth of America and your wealth, of course, to other countries. Now, we were promised, of course, we'd have all those new markets in Mexico, and nobody ever asked, where are the Mexicans going to get the money to buy our products? Nobody ever bothers to ask, where are the Chinese going to get their money to buy our products? And why would they buy our products when they can buy them so much more cheaply if they're made in China than if they're made here? In fact, you go to Walmart and you try to buy anything made in America, and you'll find out that well over 90, maybe even 95% of the products you're going to see in Walmart and Kmart are made in other countries. Very little is manufactured here anymore, because that's what the plan is all about, but we can't let the American people know that. Let me show you how the article concludes. Given how complementary the two are, speaking of our economy and the Chinese economy, American politicians who try to capitalize on the fear of communist trade aren't likely to get very far. These two growth engines of the world economy can enrich each other if they allow their bilateral trade to flourish. Yes, sir. The trade between our two countries is about $11 billion. They sell us $103 billion more than we sell them. We actually sell them $6.9 billion. They sell us $110 billion worth of products. Boy, this is a great advantage for us, isn't it? And, of course, if we have a $103 billion trade deficit this year and it grows 25%, by next year it'll be almost a $130 billion deficit. I can remember when it was $30 or $40 billion deficit, but they can't let the American people really understand what's happening. Now, Chinese imports are, if anything, poised for explosion. They rose 42% a year in the last 6 months of 2003. In joining the World Trade Organization, Beijing made major reductions in trade barriers to lock in the level of access of the world's major markets it already enjoyed. What you have to understand is that China doesn't play by the rules. They have all sorts of barriers to their people buying our products, but they can't tell the American people that, because if the American people realize that the Chinese communists are not playing by the rules, why, we'd say, well, we're not going to play by the rules anymore either. But you see, that they want to keep the American people in the dark. As little bit by little bit, we transfer America's wealth, America's industrial base, America's future, the future of your children and your grandchildren, throughout the rest of the world, because the loyalty of our leaders is to this concept of a new world order and a new world religion. And I suggest if you have the Wall Street Journal, then I will tell you the Wall Street Journal sends me two copies. One, a copy I pay for, another copy they send me just to make sure that I have it. The New York Times is doing the same thing. Many, many people are getting copies, free copies. If you're out there in the listening audience, you're getting free copies of the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. I'd love to hear from you because I am firmly convinced they're sending this out not, of course, as a promotional idea, but to control what the American people think. And, you know, we really base our ideas on what we read and in the newspapers and magazines and what we hear on the radio, what we see on television. And, of course, since the other side controls these major markets, then they're quite willing to give newspapers away entirely free so that the hope is that you will read them and that you will actually believe the lies in the newspapers. And I know my barber told me that he's getting free copies of the Wall Street Journal, which he puts out in his barber shop for people to read. And he thinks, gee, isn't it wonderful I'm getting a free newspaper, without realizing he is becoming a propagandist for the establishment dedicated to globalism, the New World Order, the New World Religion. And let me just go on. The article says, over time, this free trade is likely to lead to rising wages and trade deficits, a phenomenon that is normal and healthy for a country's experiencing rapid economic growth. In other words, what they're saying is that China is going to become so prosperous that soon they'll have rising wages and deficits in trade. In other words, they'll be importing more than they're exporting. How many people out there really believe that China is going to become a major importer of American goods? Right now, of course, we're exporting to them our factories. And of course, once those factories are over there, they're going to begin producing the goods that we have been producing here. Do you honestly think that the American worker who's making $20 an hour can compete with a Chinese peasant who's willing to work for $20 a month? Do you honestly believe that? Because if you do, you're incredibly naive. You have to understand what the real motive is, and this has always been the motive. I have an article written, I think, back in the early 1990s by David Rockefeller. It was written on the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal, where he talks about this dream of NAFTA. And he says, you know, we've been waiting for 500 years for this to come to pass. And actually, the article was written in 1992. What was he talking about, 500 years? Why, of course, 500 years, 1992, 1492, that was when Columbus came to America. And David Rockefeller is saying, we've been waiting 500 years. What's he talking about? Well, he's really talking about the fact that there is a secret brotherhood out there. There's a secret hierarchy that rules the world. And if you doubt that, we'll be glad to send you a copy of something we call the spiritual hierarchy. We don't call it. Actually, it's distributed by a Luciferian group called the Lucis Trust. And they're simply distributing something that had been written by Alice Bailey. We'll be glad to send you free of charge a copy of the spiritual hierarchy, where they brag about this group that really rules the world. But the average American has no idea about this, because we never talk about this sort of thing in our churches. We never teach about it in our schools. But if you read the writings of the occultists, of Alice Bailey, and every major city has a metaphysical bookstore, and you can go in and get Alice Bailey's books, Enlightenment of the Hierarchy, and that's not quite the name, but probably the best single book to get that would steer you in the right direction is one we carry, which is entitled The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. It's a book that changed my life back in the early 1980s when I read it. Because I'd been studying at that time, over 20 years, the various forces that rule the world, communism and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission and the Club of Rome. But I always knew I was missing something, something that was mysterious, something that was being suppressed. And it wasn't until I read The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow that I began to realize there was another factor, an X factor out there. And that was the occult, the Luciferian movement, which has been active in the world since the time of the Garden of Eden. And if you'd like to get know more about the book, The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, by a good friend, Constance Cumby, and of course, we've come to be good friends with Constance through the years, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and she has references to all the writings of Alice Bailey. Alice Bailey used to write about the New World Order and 1,000 Points of Light. You remember we had a president who talked about the New World Order and 1,000 Points of Light as a man named George Herbert Walker Bush, a member of a secret occult society known as Skull and Bones. But, well, of course, we really shouldn't say anything bad about him, because today his son, a dedicated Christian, is the President of the United States. If you'd like to know more, just give us a call. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, we're going to have a little different program this evening. We're actually going to have as a guest right now Randy Thomason, and Randy Thomason works with an organization. In fact, it's his organization. It's called the Campaign for California Families. His website is savecalifornia.com. And of course, Randy is, he used to work for the Rutherford, for another group up in Sacramento, and then he went off on his own. He actually is up there in Sacramento trying to keep track of what the politicians are doing, trying to influence the legislation there to a pro-family, a pro-Christian position. And, of course, right now, why Sacramento is in turmoil, we have a recall going. Randy, how are you doing?
I'm good, Dr. Stan. Good in my head. You know, this earth really isn't my home, but it's a good thing to be able to talk to you and your listeners today.
Well, of course, I just want you to tell our listeners what's really going on up in Sacramento. You know, we hear about Arnold Schwarzenegger, and, of course, where is he coming from? Well, we find out he's got one of his advisors, top advisor Warren Buffett, a lifelong Democrat, and yet Arnold Schwarzenegger is supposedly a Republican. And then his second advisor was George Shultz. Why, George Shultz, of course, comes from the Council on Foreign Relations. He was associated with the Gorbachev State of the World Forum. He was on the board of that, this occult organization, for years. He certainly was instrumental in getting George Bush. He was on the committee that elected George W. Bush. He, of course, had been the Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan. Of course, most people don't know he became a 33rd degree Mason. Took the 33rd degree Mason right there in the Oval Office during the closing years of his administration. And, of course, he was very close to Mikhail Gorbachev, former dictator of Russia, former head of the Soviet KGB, who then, of course, was allowed to come to America. And 6 months before he actually, that phony rebellion in Russia, why Gorbachev already had taken out the papers for the Gorbachev Foundation here in the state of California. So he knew exactly what was going to happen. It was all prepared ahead of time. And, of course, money had come from many of our great corporations to establish the Green Cross Foundation, which is centered here in California, became the State of the World Forum. So here we have George Shultz now working with Arnold Schwarzenegger, supposedly a conservative Republican. And then, of course, his wife is a Kennedy, lifelong Democrat. So it seems that we have socialist certainly competing with Bustamante, another socialist. And then we have Bill Simon. And I don't know what you think about Bill Simon, but he comes from the Council on Foreign Relations family. And then we have Tom McClintock, and we've got another 130 candidates running for the governor. What sort of madness is this?
Well, Dr. Stan, I want to encourage you and your listeners to still vote in the recall election. 6.5 weeks away now. It's going to be very interesting, and I believe that it's possible to elect a good guy. You know, it's really interesting when you look at, you know, you talk very very authoritatively about George Shultz's background. That's one advisor to Schwarzenegger. Another advisor is actor Rob Lowe, a Democrat activist. You know, it's hard to see what Schwarzenegger believes. He actually had a sit down meeting with the California Teachers Association. That's a group that promotes homosexuality and transsexuality in the school system, as well as abortion, while trampling parental rights, and wanting always to take more and more money out of our pockets. Is he promising them something? It's very interesting, to say the least. But Dr. Stan, have you heard about Bustamante yet?
No. Well, first, I know that he is one of these people who wants to give California back to Mexico. He's a longtime socialist. But tell me what you think of Bustamante.
Well, I can only look at what this man actually supports in terms of policy. Now, it was several years ago when he was an assemblyman He actually has taken positions this year on some radical pieces of legislation. Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante supports AB 205, the homosexual marriage bill that awards, quote, all the rights of marriage to domestic partners in California. Cruz Bustamante supports AB 196, which is the transsexual bill that fines business owners up to $150,000 if they don't hire a transsexual or a cross-dresser applicant. Again, this is no exception for religious faith in this bill. Cruz Bustamante also is in official support of what I call the transsexual foster care bill. AB 458 would force foster parents into sensitivity training to teach them to accept any sexual behavior among foster children. They're not supposed to be having sex of any kind in the home, and most foster homes are run by parents of faith, foster parents who have been recruited out of churches, and they wouldn't take those classes. They would rather quit as a foster parent than submit, and that would mean a net loss of foster homes in California. That's what Cruz Bustamante stands for, Dr. Stan. And it's very interesting. On the marriage issue, AB 205, as you know, because you follow these things very closely, has been endorsed by not only Cruz Bustamante, but Governor Gray Davis says he's going to sign the bill. He said that he thinks it's a matter of fairness for Californians. I say, well, where is the fairness for the voters? Where is the respect for voters? The people of California voted over 61.4% to protect the rights of marriage for only a man and a woman. That was Proposition 22 just 3 years ago. And I testified against AB 205 Monday in the Senate Appropriations Committee. And Dr. Stan, I was steamed. I held up the Proposition 22 Protect Marriage yard sign, and I said, remember this? The people demanded that the rights of marriage be protected for a man and a woman. I told them it would be unconstitutional for them to reverse the people's vote. Now, the vote has been delayed. It's going to be next Monday, but this bill is expected to move forward. I'm working very hard behind the scenes on a lawsuit against this, also working on some other maneuvers, some other strategies to protect the people's vote on marriage. This is not one we're going to take just sitting down, and now is the time for people to rise up and call Cruz Bustamante and call Gray Davis and call their state senator in California and say, I'm steamed. I'm upset about the rejection of the people's vote on marriage. That's what AB 205 would do.
All right, fine. Well, I'm glad to know that you're up there. How can people get in touch with you, Randy, and your ministry?
Dr. Stan, they can reach us at our website, SaveCalifornia.com. SaveCalifornia.com, where you can sign up for email updates. But you can also, at our website, click Legislators, and it will take you to a page where you can find your California State Senator. I would urge you to call first thing tomorrow morning your California State Senator and say, hey, I want you to oppose AB 205. This bill is terrible. If you're a Democrat senator, how can you do this? Don't you believe in democracy?
Well, of course, you have to understand there is a political agenda behind everything going on, and behind that a spiritual agenda. And how do you think God feels about our state, our society, that has turned its back on him and his holy teachings?
Dr. Stan, in my written testimony, which I was not able to fully deliver, I was to say to these legislators, who made you God? To think you have the right to redefine and recreate this sacred institution called marriage by cutting it up into pieces to serve your own interests is demeaning and challenging the very creator of marriage, the one who challenges you with the truth, if you had a respect for truth and would accept it. I was able to ask them, who made you king? Because it's time for a civilized revolt in California. This is starting to make news everywhere. We were in the Washington Times today talking about how Gray Davis and Cruz Bustamante want to reject the vote of the people. So there's a movement underway. Let's not be fatalistic. Let's actually say, God, use my phone calls to my state senators to raise the roof on AB 205 because this battle is far from over.
All right. God bless you. Thank you so much, Randy. We'll talk to you at the regular time next week, God willing.
Thank you for you, Dr. Stan.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, fine. Well, now we'll go to our friend Brad Dacus. And Brad Dacus is has an organization. It's called it's called the Pacific Justice Institute. And, of course, he deals with legal matters that deal with churches or efforts to persecute or prosecute people of faith, and of course they provide pro bono services under these circumstances. Brad, tell us what's happening in the legal field at the present time.
Well, Dr. Stanley, I tell you, we had a very dramatic week this last week, and I was invited to appear, and I did. I spoke at the American Bar Association's National Convention in San Francisco. Now, this is the largest legal organization in the country, and it's known for being very, very liberal. And so I spoke at their convention, and at the time, basically what we did is we put them on notice that if those cities attorneys represent don't fully comply with the Religious Land Use Act, which is there to protect churches, we're going to sue them. And we made it very clear, and I'm hoping that this will result in many cities hearing from their attorneys from this national convention that they better change their policies and not get in the way of churches building in their communities.
Well, now, how did it happen that they let a radical like you address the American Bar Association, American Legal Association? Do you have some undercover Christians or people in the organization that snuck you in?
Well, there were just a few Christians there in the audience and their attorneys, and they signed up actually to be part of our team. But no, the reason is because the reason they had me speak 3 years ago is because we have so many cases defending churches and suing cities that they wanted to make sure they provided the other side, the other opinion. And I think we were sort of the obvious choice because of all the cases we do. If we weren't doing the work, we wouldn't have been invited. When you take on as many cases that we do, defend as many churches as we do in private schools and Christian colleges, I think it just sort of came fit into place. But the first time I spoke there, I started off my speech telling him why I wasn't a member of the ABA. So frankly, I didn't think I'd ever be invited back. But nonetheless, they did, and I think God came through, and hopefully it's going to save taxpayers the burden of having to deal with foolish cities forcing us to sue them.
Well, I think the important thing is to realize there is an anti-Christian bigotry on the part of many people, and of course they'll do everything they can to block churches building on their own property or expanding or even holding Bible studies in private homes. And of course they try to use their planning commission or any sort of guise that they possibly can to make the life of Christians difficult. And of course, how do you fight the City Hall? Well, of course, you go to Brad Dacus at a Pacific Justice Institute, and he represents people pro bono. And I think what's really so exciting is that there really are Christian lawyers out there. We make fun of lawyers, but, you know, when you're in a pinch, why, it's sure nice to have a good one on your side. And I've been in that position on more than one occasion. And, of course, you get a lot of Christian lawyers who actually give their time for nothing to help you in your efforts.
Oh, absolutely. And we're getting new recruits all the time. And if there's an attorney out there that would like to know more about what we're doing and our referral service, et cetera, how we pick up the costs and expenses for cases and things, they should feel free to contact us. Or if there's a church out there that needs assistance, or a city council member who wants some special legal guidance and assistance without charge on this issue of religious land use and the like, they should always feel free to give us a call. And we're just very, very busy. That's all I can say.
Well, why don't you give us your telephone number? How could people, if they wanted to get in touch with you, reach you?
Oh, you bet. Also, if they want to get our press releases or free case updates, we make those available. Two ways. One is call our toll-free number. It's 888-305-9129, 888-305-9129, or our webpage, which is pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org.
And, of course, you are right here in California, but you take cases all up and down the coast because we have a lot of listeners this evening who are up in the state of Washington.
Oh, absolutely. We have about 40 affiliate attorneys in Seattle alone. So and also in Spokane, we have attorneys. So definitely, we're here to help them.
And let me, of course, point out to our listeners in the great Northwest that Brad is totally dedicated in this. He's not getting not here to get a lot of money. He's works on a very meager salary, but he believes in what he's doing. And I've known Brad, I guess, probably well over a decade, and I've watched him get married and watched him develop and watched him create this organization. It was a wonderful dream. Wondered if he was going to be able to make it go, but he has. He has a lot of support, but he needs your support as well. To finance these lawsuits, and of course they take these courses, these cases, and of course they will sometimes even get settlements for people, you know, because this is the only way we can stop this bigotry. And there is anti-Christian bigotry out there, and they're using the power of government to persecute Christians, and it is part of this whole spiritual battle in which we're engaged. Well, this is really exciting. Is there any other good cases you'd like to report, or anything else exciting happened this week?
Well, I could just say that we're in the middle of preparing to do something involving the recall. I can't give the details, but I think it's going to be, frankly, one of our most exciting cases we've ever handled, and I just encourage the audience to keep us in their prayers as we put together our legal strategy, what we're going to do.
All right, and of course, for our listeners out there who don't know, a federal judge has said, oh, well, we're going to have to put this on hand for this or that. Hold it. You can't have the election until March or something next year. And these are all the little games that they played. This is what they did with Prop 187 here, which would, of course, cut off welfare benefits and all sorts of benefits for people who were here in California illegally. The people voted for it overwhelmingly, and they went to a federal judge who held it up until Gray Davis got into office, and then, of course, he refused to go ahead and appeal it. You know, he didn't go along with the will of the people, with the law of the state of California, and today we have a lawless governor. He simply said, well, we're not going to appeal it because I don't think it should be appealed. Totally ignoring the will of the majority, the actual law of California, which is Prop 187. Can that 187 ever be brought back again, since it is the law of the state?
Well, I think it can, but we definitely need a new governor to allow it to.
I know. Well, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see how this whole thing plays out. And anyway, God bless you for everything you're doing, and I hope maybe next week or so while you'll let us know what this legal plan that you have and how you're going to be working behind the scenes, because somebody has to represent the interests of the people of the state of California, and I know you're right there on the front lines. God bless you, Brad.
Thank you. Thanks,
bye-bye.
Dr. Stanley. Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, this is the time, because we have about, 13 minutes before the program ends, and I just think there are so many exciting things going on, and we do hope that many of you up there in the state of Washington are watching what's happening. And I think you have to understand the California recall. And really, of course, the people here of California are very, very upset because, of course, of the handling of the energy crisis. They would not allow the utility companies, PG&E, Southern California Edison, certainly San Diego Light and Electricity, I guess there were three major companies, they would not allow them to buy future contracts so that they could get reasonable electricity. Oh, no, you can't be allowed to buy future contracts. You're going to have to buy it on the open market, you know, at 100 times what it ought to cost, or 200 times. And then, of course, after they've got this terrible crisis and situation, the governor intervenes and he buys $43 billion worth of electricity going out 20 years. And we're only going to have a crisis, you know, for a month or so. $43 billion of future contracts at exorbitant fees, three or four or five times what the electricity should cost. And, of course, the man who is, of course, negotiating with the companies just happens to be getting $200,000 a year from one of the major utilities. And the whole thing is corrupt, and there obviously was a lot of money that changed hands. We can't prove that, but when the governor appoints a man who's on the salary of Southern California Edison to negotiate contracts with all of these companies, you know very well it's a scam. $43 billion of our money that is going to, most of it's going to be wasted. And, of course, Gray Davis has no intention of renegotiating those contracts. And then, of course, we have to understand that Gray Davis was increasing spending here in California 10% a year. So of when he came into office, why, he had a $12 billion surplus, you know, so we wouldn't get into problems. And he increased spending over a period of 4 years by $40 billion. So our state budget went from about $60 billion to $100 billion under Davis. Massive government spending for government jobs. And, of course, all these people would vote for the government. But the trouble is, when the economy turned down, why then what are you going to do when there's no money? Well, they have two options. One is to increase taxes, and the other is to decrease spending. They have no intention of decreasing spending, because if you decrease spending, people are going to lose their jobs, and then they're not going to vote for the current administration. So you're buying your way, and of course, into a political office with the taxpayers' money. And of course, fortunately, the Republicans held strong. Here in California, you have to have two-thirds majority to get a budget through. And although the Democrats have a comfortable majority, they were never able to get a two-thirds a majority to vote for their legislation. So what they did is they came up with a wonderful idea. Now, well, we have a $100 billion budget. How are we going to fund it? Well, we're going to borrow money from future generations, and we're going to pay probably twice as much for that money because, of course, our bond rating has fallen so low. We're just two levels above the junk bonds. We have the lowest level that any state in the United States has ever had as far as our bond rating is concerned. I think only one other state has ever had such a low rating. That's going to cost us hundreds of millions of dollars additional to fund the bonds, of course, that were already were committed to, and another $10 or $12 billion we're going to borrow in bonds so we can pay the bills this year. And then we're going to put forward to next year an $8 billion deficit. So we start next year with an $8 billion deficit. Now, we're already, of course, laying off about 30,000 people. We should be laying off several hundred thousand people. We've got more people here in this state that, you know, are uncomfortable government jobs, and many of them, of course, work in the legislature. And, you know, facing this terrible budget deficit, they were still allowing the insurance commissioner to be given a free car, and they could get any car they wanted, an SVU, a Cadillac, you know, anything that you want, the state is going to pay for it. They're not going to pay for a car for me or for you, but they're going to get it for the state legislators, and they have any car they want to, and they have all sorts of side benefits. And the governor was, of course, paying off his political debts, hiring people, you know, to work full-time for the state, who already had other full-time jobs working for the state. So they were getting a double salary. That gives double-dipping a bad name. I mean, this is a totally corrupt administration. Now, I'm not picking on them just because they're Democrats, because sometimes the Republicans will do the same thing. But here, at least here in California, why it would appear that the Republicans are doing a lot better than the Democrats as far as integrity are concerned. And if you disagree with that, give me a call, and I certainly will accept the fact that there are corruption within both political parties. It's just at least the Republicans held the line against increasing taxes. And you say, well, why not tax the very wealthy? Well, you want to tax the very wealthy, they're going to pick up and leave the state. And you're not only going to lose the taxes that they're paying, but, of course, you're going to lose the business that they would be producing. And, of course, we have a workman's compensation system, which is the most expensive in the entire nation. The workman's compensation system in Arizona provides coverage for injured workers on the job, but only costs about a third as much as the one here in the state of California. And, you know, in the one in California, despite the fact it is the most expensive in the nation, why, they're still cutting the income to doctors, and more doctors are going to simply drop out of the workman's compensation system, and you're going to have nothing but chaos. It's a massive bureaucracy, a massive giveaway, and, of course, it's not going to help the workers in the long run. I've seen too many people involved in the workman's compensation system who become so emotionally involved in this whole thing that they become chronic invalids simply because of the way that they're treated within this system. It's a totally corrupt system, and instead of helping people, sometimes it does help, but many, many times it's harmful, and it is taken advantage of. So we've got a corrupt system. Of course, they've increased the car taxes. They've tripled the car taxes in violation of the law. But they say, well, it's really not a car tax. It's a car fee. And so since it's a fee and not a tax, we can raise it. Well, of course, they're simply having play on names and play on words, and the great, great tragedy is the average individual really doesn't understand what is going on. We have a government that is simply out of control. We had here in the state of California, starting a few years ago, the fifth largest economy in the entire world. In other words, if California were an independent state, we would be the fifth largest economy. There'd be the United States, there would be Japan, there would be Germany, there would be Great Britain, there would be China, and then there'd be the state of California. I think we're down to about seventh now, but this is just going to continue declining. We are being bankrupted by illegal aliens. Do you realize an illegal alien can come in here into California and get a subsidized education at our universities? Certainly the governor and the Democrats want, of course, to give driver's license to people who are in this country illegally. What sort of madness is this? Our hospitals are required to provide free medical care, emergency medical care, to people who are here illegally. In fact, if you go into Mexico, if you are in Mexico, and you're a Mexican, and you have a serious injury, and you go to the hospital anywhere close to the border, and you don't have any insurance, and it's going to cost a lot of money to help you, they simply put you in an ambulance, they bring you across the border, and of course those ambulances are simply waved through the border crossings. They take you to an American hospital where they, by law, are forced to take you as a patient. And, of course, then, of course, you and I have to cost share for that. And, of course, it runs up the cost of health care. And many of our trauma centers in the Southern California are simply closing down because of all of the illegal aliens without funds that they're forced to treat by government mandate without any compensation. Well, right now we've got Mary calling from Covina. Hi, Mary. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I talked to you last week about ISA and the fact that he had chosen not to run.
Right.
And since then, somebody said that he was told by the president or the government, you know, the federal government, that he could not run.
Well, I really don't know anything about that. Can you document that anyplace? Because there are a lot of things that are said, but, you know, I just want to see some documentation. Can you find any documentation on that, Mary?
I don't think I can. That was what I was wondering if you had heard that.
Well, I really haven't, and I don't know how they could tell him he couldn't run. We have, senators who run for the presidency, like Lieberman. Why couldn't, of course, a congressman run for governor?
Well, of course, we know that they want Schwarzenegger in, but is there any way that if people really wanted someone else that they could just write them in?
With 135 candidates, I think it would be a matter of futility. I mean, we've really got about five candidates. We've got Bustamante and Garamendi. Is it Garamendi, the state insurance commissioner? Then, of course, we've got Schwarzenegger, Simon, Tom McClintock, and Peter Ustinov. I guess that's six candidates. That's all that are really involved running. And we've got all these other people that don't stand a chance. So why bother to waste your vote?
Well, you said something last time we talked about maybe getting ISA to come on the show. I really wish you could get him on.
All right, I'll tell you what, Mary. I've been thinking about that. I'd just like to talk to him. My producer said that perhaps because he had funded the recall, somebody suggested it would look bad for the Republicans if he were to run. And, of course, what Gray Davis is saying, well, this is a conspiracy on the part of the right-wing Republicans who want to take advantage of this thing to depose the man who was legally elected by the people. He never points out, of course, that he and Reardon and Simon hold many views in common, that Simon and Reardon ran to block Bill Jones, who was a real good conservative. But, of course, they're never going to tell the people the truth. That's the great tragedy of today. Hey, we're just about out of time. Thank you so much for calling, Mary, and I'll see if I can get Daryl Issa on the line, okay?
Thanks.
God bless. Good night. Well, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and I certainly hope that many of you out there want to join the Radio Liberty family. Join us in this epic struggle to determine if this nation or any nation under God can long endure. We ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because if America doesn't turn back to God, why, this country will be lost. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until, tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us this evening Ron Arnold. And Ron, of course, is one of the great warriors in this battle to expose what's happening in the environmental movement. He's written some wonderful treatises and books on this subject. And we're going to be talking this evening about the source of funding for the environmental movement. And the old story is, follow the money. Where is it coming from? Well, a lot of people look at the environmental movement and said, boy, these fellows have to have a lot of power. You know, how else are they able to block the development of nuclear energy, shut down the forests, enforce the Endangered Species Act, block, you know, the implementation of building of roads and things like that? Oh, these people got to have a lot of power. But, of course, where does their power come from? I mean, it's a pretty motley group of people, if you've ever seen a lot of these environmentalists, and even those with a coat and tie on, certainly, their power has never been their own power. Would that be a fair statement, Ron?
Well, Dr. Stan, I certainly think it is. It's one of the truisms that I discovered that following the money always comes up with a lot of surprises.
All right. Well, why don't you explain to our leaders who's behind this and why are some of the wealthiest people in America doing everything they can to undermine the stability of our society?
Well, let's take those one at a time. Who's behind this? One of the first things you have to realize about the environmental movement, it's not about the environment. It's about power. And how do you get power? Well, money is the easiest way. And, of course, the people with money in the world are used to wielding power. And they look at environmental groups as their cat's paws, as an instrument, as the puppets dangling on their strings to pull off agendas to make sure that things happen their way. Now, some of them are very obvious, like all you have to do is think of this wonderful island off the coast of Maine where David Rockefeller Jr., one of the huge Rockefeller clan, has this nice private island, and somebody comes along behind his island where he can't even see it from his castle there and says, I want to put in a fish farm or something like that that will actually feed people. Well, of course, he doesn't want anything like that that even smacks of business or industry. He wants his beautiful nature all to himself. And so when this, let's say, a fish farming company comes in and says, we're going to put a few pens here and raise salmon, let's say, and they go to get a state permit and all of the federal permits, well, guess who shows up at the permit hearings and says, no, you can't do this because of, and carts out this load of federal law, state law, saying, no, you shouldn't do this. And the regulators who were ready to give the permit to them say, well, we don't see anything wrong with this. Well, all of this stuff you're talking about, they did all the right things. They followed the procedures. And so they're, by way of giving the permit to the salmon raising company, the fish farming company, and suddenly a lawsuit pops up from a Ralph Nader group down in Boston, you know, 200 miles away. Or you get this thing from the Pew Oceans Commission down in Washington, D.C., 500, 600 miles away. Suddenly they're all looking at this little island off the coast of Maine saying, no, you can't do this because of, and then fill in the blank with some law that they happen to pick up that says, no, you can't do that. Well, all of that came because David Rockefeller Jr. gave a bunch of money to various people to bring the lawsuit and to keep nasty people out of their backyards. Now, that's the most obvious thing that you can see, but there's a lot more sinister stuff behind it than that. That's mere selfishness. But what we also find is that there's a political agenda behind a lot of this, Dr. Stan, and I think that that's not much of a rocket science item with most people. They could guess that there's something more than just selfishness. There's got to be some kind of political gain here. Well, what is it? Some of it is just plain anti-corporate. Now, harking back again to the Rockefeller family, there's a very famous quote from one of the fourth generation Rockefellers that says, "We give money from our foundation to people to change the system so that people like us can't exist anymore." In other words, they're saying they're guilty for all this unearned wealth that they grew up with and all of the privilege. And then all you have to think about this from their viewpoint, all of the pressure that they're expected to live up to because they've got a big name like the Pew family. That was Sun Oil, or W. Alton Jones family, that was Citgo Oil, and a lot of these other foundations that are now in the second and third generation of wealth. They're actually out there to try to change the system so that capitalism, plain old free market enterprise, can't really exist anymore. That is all going to be taken over by government regulation and command and control kind of socialistic type government.
But that's the sort of government they have in Russia.
Well, it's also the kind of government they've got in Canada. Stop and think of it. It's a socialist nation. We don't think very much about the fact that, yeah, it's a socialist nation. They've got socialized medicine, socialized employment, socialized everything. United Kingdom, England, that's a socialist nation. So is France. So is Germany. So is the Netherlands. So is all of Scandinavia. So the kind of socialism usually goes under some pretty name like social democracy or something that you don't really think of socialism. But if you go into those countries and you say socialism is not a dirty word like it is in the United States to many people, it's just the way things are. But you find out that if you live there, there are certain things, certain freedoms you just don't have that you do here in the United States. And I think that many people here don't want to give up those freedoms for the sake of some environmentalist who thinks that corporations are big, bad, evil things. And if you take a look at the actions of some corporations since the Enron scandals and the WorldCom scandals, they give capitalism a bad name, all right, and there's no question about that. And they certainly have to clean up their acts, and the organization that I run, Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise, is certainly behind any movement to make sure that corporations do it fair and square, that they follow all of the laws, and that they're good citizens. And I think everybody wants that. But you can see that there are a lot of people that, under the guise of saying, well, we just want to make them good citizens, are actually trying to pass new laws, enforce old laws, to make sure that corporations simply can't exist anymore and that corporate enterprise vanishes in favor of what we used to see in the Soviet Union back in the days before it became the Russian Federation. So there are a lot of motives. But I think here's probably the real secret to understanding what's going on, and that is you can't think of the environmental movement as if it was solid like a potato, the same through and through. It's not. You have to know how many different groups there are, what kinds of groups, what kind of people, the actual personal biography, the life story of the people who are running each of the different groups, before you have a clear idea of the quirks and oddities that you see. Every now and then you'll see some environmental group that gets a wonderful reputation among business people, like the Nature Conservancy, and yet you find them going out and destroying the small property owner's property rights by saying, well, we're going to buy up all of the land around you, and we're going to donate it to some park or another, and then we're going to surround you. Then your land won't be worth anything anymore. We'll come buy it from you for nothing, or we'll convince the government to just take it away from you. And then you can fight in court to get a pittance, a fraction of what it really is worth now. But on the other hand, if you sell to us now, we'll give you 10 cents on the dollar, but you can deduct the other 90 cents on the dollar from your income tax as a charitable donation to our wonderful organization. Well, you know, that's almost like the Godfather movies, making them an offer they can't refuse. What do you do with a big outfit like that that's got more than $1 billion worth of assets, a third of $1 billion worth of annual revenue, and businesses love it for reasons of their own? Most of the reasons are is that because the Nature Conservancy had already got so much land that it took away from smallholders, if you get involved in one of these horrible situations, like you come into a nice town and you want to build a corporate campus so that there will be more jobs in that area, and you suddenly discover that you're on the outskirts of the yellow-breasted warbler's nesting habitat or some such thing as that, and that the law says, in the Endangered Species Act, if you want to develop 1 acre here, you have to buy 5 acres somewhere else where this bird or animal or snake or spider, whatever it happens to be, has habitat and it can live, and you have to donate that to the federal government, plus you have to donate a pile of money so they can manage that land in perpetuity. So you end up spending tons of money buying 5 times more land than you're going to use. You go through all that fall draw. Where are you going to find that land? Well, of course, the Nature Conservancy bought it all up by this kind of pressure tactic from the poor little guys that couldn't fight it. And so the corporation says, oh, that's wonderful. You have some of this. It's called mitigation land. Get that? Isn't that a nicey word for stolen land? But here's this mitigation land that we can buy 5 acres of that for every acre that we want, that we need in order to build our corporate campus, and this new business that we're going to try to start and employ some people. So they're happy to pay all of the money because they're a big corporation, and it's just a cost of doing business to them, not like a little homeowner, and that's his home that's going away. So they love the Nature Conservancy in some businesses. Some of them have caught on and realized that it's not really a very good thing to do the way they do business. But you get some businesses that like those kind of environmental groups for just that kind of reason, that they can provide something that they don't care how it got that way. It's land that they can buy to satisfy the Endangered Species Act requirements. If you're going to build something, you have to have many times more land that you give to the government to protect the habitat. Well, now, that's so convoluted, you'd never see a story like that in the newspaper. So, Dr. Stan, this truly is something your program does that nobody else does. It's the story behind the story. You're never going to see anything that involved in a newspaper, let me assure you.
Well, I was reading the other day where the General Motors had given, I don't know, 20 or so SVUs to the Nature Conservancy so that they could go out and check, of course, what was happening in the forest that they were trying to control. So certainly we find many of our major corporations making common cause over these radical environmental groups, which are dedicated to buying up the property and, of course, getting away from the individual. And, of course, one of the basic tenets of freedom is private property. And, of course, one of the basic tenets of socialism is government control of property.
Well, absolutely. And I think the more people are aware of that, the more they're going to be up in arms to make sure that our private property rights aren't just frittered away or surrendered by people who find themselves helpless, that the rest of us do have to band together, like our organization makes common cause with other organizations of like mind, such as the Heritage Foundation, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a number of other pro-free enterprise groups. And when we see someone attacked, we will come to their aid. We will help find them lawyers and groups like Mountain States Legal Foundation, Pacific Legal Foundation. They will even go to bat for them in court. Usually they will go out and fundraise on their own so that the little person, the victim, doesn't have to come up with hundreds of thousands of dollars to fight it in court. And these public interest law firms on our side of the issue are very, very important in trying to fight for private property rights and keep them out of the hands of these environmental groups that just go around essentially mugging little property owners here and there that just don't have the means to defend themselves.
Well, I know people I know here in the Monterey Bay area have certainly timberland. And, of course, the land, of course, its value is the timber that's on it. And yet here, of course, they have the marbled marlet. And, of course, like the spotted owl, the marble marlin might at some time want to come onto this land. Therefore, we can't allow any timber to be cut. And, of course, by not cutting timber, why, of course, you create the basis for raging fires. The trees grow better if they're selective harvesting. But, of course, they will come in and they will effectively block any lumbering, which means the property is useless. All you can do is pay taxes on it. How do you fight something like that?
Well, it isn't easy, Dr. Stan, and one of the ways that we have found that you can effectively fight it is make sure that every time somebody's got a plan like that, it receives a lot of publicity, very negative publicity, pointing out the fact that essentially you're stealing the cutting rights from the people who own it. And you can take them to court, actually, for interfering with business relations. We've had a number of cases where we've actually won. And showing that, look, there is no basis that the marbled murrelet or the spotted owl or the pygmy owl actually lives here or is going to need this for habitat. And you can do probably the most difficult but heroic kind of thing, and that is you can go prove the case that one of these animals on the endangered species list really is not endangered, that there are a lot more than anybody ever counted, that they're doing perfectly fine in lots and lots of places, and that if you cut some trees here, the pygmy owls didn't live there in the first place, and they are not likely to ever live there because they never have. And if you can make that case, I'm happy to say that just today, the Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco, not known for its pro-free enterprise or pro-property rights decisions, came out and approved the delisting of the pygmy owl from the endangered species list. That's very difficult to do, but that means it's one less stumbling block. And remember, a lot of these animals that they say are terribly endangered are in no way endangered. Some of them are, and that's the difficult thing for the average person who really doesn't want to hurt. I mean, who wants to go out and hurt nature? Nobody. You'd have to be crazy to do that. At the same time, they don't want to hurt employment, the supply of goods and services that we all use and need to keep a good standard of living. So they don't know how to judge a situation like that. Is the pygmy owl really threatened? Well, no, it's not. We've made that case in a court of law now. But is the California condor really threatened? Well, you bet it is. Because there aren't very many of them left, and that's the kind of thing the law was originally intended to protect, the great grizzly bears, and the bald eagle, a symbol of America, and other great animals of that nature. And now it's gotten down to, they've got so many on the list, they're getting down to spiders and salamanders and bugs, and we're now worried they're actually going to start putting microbes on the list, you know, save the smallpox. So it's essentially become a save the pests movement more than it is a save the important animals movement. And trying to sort that out is really very difficult, but it takes dedicated people who believe both in saving nature and saving free enterprise and want to find where the truth really lies. And when these people in the environmental movement come up saying, oh, this species is endangered, look, it's got all of these terrible things happening here and there, make them prove it. Make them prove it. Make them live up to their own rule book.
But, of course, they come up with a scientist who, for free, will say whatever they want to, and that is the great tragedy we're facing. We have people out there hiding behind scientists who are frankly lying.
Well, that's absolutely true, and I think that when you, if you really look at science, now, I actually learned this from a philosopher of science named Paul Feyerabend. Now, he lives and teaches in Australia as a professor of the philosophy of science. And he pointed out that, look, if you think science is value-free and is totally objective, that's nonsense. Because, for one thing, science itself was invented in a particular culture at a particular time. It's not universal. It hasn't been there forever. It is a very handy way of knowing things. And people say, oh, well, it's look at the results that it's had. Well, no, that's technology. Sometimes it uses science, but remember, people had invented all the things in technology that we use, like electricity, the telephone and television, things like that. They weren't doing that with science. They were guessing in the dark. And a lot of this stuff came about by accident by people like Edison, who was a tinkerer. He wasn't a scientist. Like he said, it's mostly 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. But, you know, this problem has been around for a long time, Dr. Stan, and that's the problem of scientists that are masquerading as if they were telling the absolute, objective, unbiased truth, when as a matter of fact, they have a political agenda. In fact, there was years ago, one of the places that was my wake-up call was the fact you could go into a courtroom, let's say this is 30 years ago, where a lot of all of this problem was just becoming known, and you would have this party on one side of the issue that came up with this wonderful scientist who was Dr. So-and-so from a prestigious university, and he'd published a lot of books and written a lot of scientific papers and was very highly regarded by all of his colleagues. Then the other lawyer would come in with another scientist from an equally prestigious but different university, and he'd written an equal number of books and published an equal number of scientific papers in prestigious journals and was just as highly regarded by people in his scientific circle. And you would give them both the very same raw data, the very same facts of the case, and they would come up with diametrically opposite conclusions about it. And the judges and the lawyers looked at this and said, what? How is that possible? We thought science was objective. Well, no, it's not. And if you think that you can have a call for sound science, as if you put an adjective in the word of science, you suddenly changed its nature, no, that's not going to work. And I know there's a bill in Congress right now to require sound science. The problem is, it depends on who's sitting in the big chair in the White House as to what the administration will agree is sound science. Is it the science of Dr. A or Dr. B? Well, that's a matter of politics, isn't it? So the only way you can really have some idea is to require in any government decision that needs to be taken by Congress or the administration that you have a spectrum of scientific viewpoints about the issue, and then you have an actually fair political kind of choice to make, since if you stop and think about it, you know the old joke that military intelligence is an oxymoron. In other words, it's a contradiction. A lot of people who don't like the military have used that for years. Well, government science is equally an oxymoron. If you're in the government, your job is making policy. And if you're making policy, that's politics. And if you're a scientist, you're supposed to be coming up with the objective truth. And the fact that you can find two scientists that look at the world and come up with two totally different explanations of what you're looking at tells you that the objective truth is political also. That in order to find out what's really going on in the world, don't look to scientists because they're not going to tell you much more than the witch doctor did 5,000 years ago, because they both have the same goals, and that is to make policy. So what you need in order to be able to judge for yourself as a one-man, one vote, in a democracy, what you need is a spectrum of viewpoints about the science on any given issue so you can make your choice. You know, scientist number A says, oh, global warming is terrible. It's going to destroy the world at 11 o'clock this afternoon or this evening. And another scientist says, no, their global warming isn't happening at all. As a matter of fact, we're probably going to suffer, if anything, from global cooling. And then you get probably the third scientist you'd want in there is the TV weatherman who says the weather tomorrow will be rain and, of course, the sun shines. That tells you how reliable such, quote, scientific predictions are. So the problem is really one of be just as skeptical of the scientist as you would be of anybody in politics, because you're probably looking at political science anytime you hear a scientist talking about what we ought to be doing.
Well, let's get back perhaps to the who is funding this. But right now we have Nathan, and I'm going to of course I'm going to ask Nathan to hold a little bit because I really want to get into why do some of the major corporations fund the environmental movement when it would appear that the very things that they're doing are undermining the the things they produce, making it more difficult for them. Could you give us some examples of some of the major corporations that are deeply involved with funding the environmental movement? Because I know you have these listed in your book. And incidentally, let's get the name of your book out and, of course, how people can get it.
Okay, well, let's go to the book title first, Dr. Stan. And the name of the book is Undue Influence.
Undue Influence.
And its subtitle is Wealthy Foundations, Grant-Driven Environmental Groups, and Zealous Bureaucrats That Control Your Future. But you don't remember that, just go to Amazon.com, put in Undue Influence, and you'll be able to find the book easily.
And it's an excellent book.
One of the things that I've also done as a public service is to create a website called UndueInfluence.com that has a lot of information about who's paying for the environmental groups. And to the surprise of a lot of people, it's not the big corporations that are putting most of it in, that actually it's a few of them that have suffered shakedowns from Greenpeace that will occupy the ships that are bringing their supplies in and not let them enter the harbor and tie them up in court and do all kinds of things. And they finally say, I give up. Well, here's some money, Greenpeace, go away. It's almost like payoff money. It's a shakedown money. Who it really is the giant foundations that were formed by a corporate giant some years back and is now, instead of being in control of the donor, the wealthy business person, is now in control of a professional elite of managers who treats it just like it was a fund that has an endowment and is made up of a stock portfolio just like any wealthy person would be, and that they're going to do with it what they think charitable money ought to be done with. And so it's big foundations like the MacArthur Foundation, like ones that you haven't even heard of, like the Cerdna Foundation, which is very big and very influential. And in order to study these, it's really not that easy. You have to know how to find out where the money's coming from and who gets it. And that's why I put this website, UndueInfluence.com, on the web, so that you can go take a look at the top page and you'll see navigation bars on the very top page that say foundations. You can go in and look. And when you go there, you'll find a list of foundations that give tons of money. Like the Ford Foundation, the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Not a lot of people have heard of that, but the Foundation for Deep Ecology was created by Doug Tompkins, and that's a name nobody even knows who is that. That's the Esprit clothing fortune. Every time you go into a fashionable store, you can see Esprit brand of clothing. Well, he used to own that company, and he sold out his interest and took some of the money and created this Foundation for Deep Ecology, and has done all kinds of dirty work. You'll find ones that you haven't heard of, like the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Fund. Well, that comes from an insurance company by a guy named Richard Goldman, but his wife Rhoda was an heir of the jeans company, and that is the Levi Strauss family. And so, you know, all kinds of rich people. And everybody's heard of Hewlett-Packard. Well, both of those guys, there is a Hewlett Foundation and a Packard Foundation, and both of them give tons of money to environmental groups. Now, here's the thing. The businesses are no longer have anything whatsoever to do with those foundations. They're not even related. That the individual, the owner of the interest in the business, like David Packard in the Hewlett-Packard company, he gave his own personal fortune to the David and Lucille Packard Foundation. That's the whole name of their outfit. And now they have professional managers giving the money to environmental groups with a $6 billion endowment. Now, that's a lot of money. You also have the General Motors money got in it, but General Motors itself doesn't give money to environmental groups. But one of the guys who is a very high official, Charles Stuart Mott, in the early days of General Motors, has a Charles Stuart Mott Foundation. Same thing. Professionals managing the money of a person who's been dead for a generation.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment or two with our special guest this evening, Ron Arnold. How about people like Ted Turner and Ben and Jerry's? Are they involved?
Oh, absolutely. They've both got foundations, and you can find profiles of Ben and Jerry's Foundation and the Turner Foundation on my Undue Influence website.
We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Ron Arnold, his book, Undue Influence, and you can go, of course, to his webpage, undueinfluence.org, and pull it down. We've got Nathan patiently hanging on here. Nathan, do you have a question or comment for us?
Well, yes. Hello, Mr. Arnold.
Hello there.
Dr. Arnold, excuse me. I got a little bit confused about something you were saying earlier. Correct me if I'm wrong, because maybe I misheard you, but are you suggesting these two points, A, that there is no such thing as objective truth, and B, that majority rules should decide what truth is?
No, as a matter of fact, what I was saying was quite the opposite, that whatever objective truth there is out there doesn't get very much of a hearing in public policy making. That's the big dividing line. An objective scientist, you can find them by the dozen, but they're not usually testifying before Congress. And that's the real problem, that if you're out there looking to find out what are atoms made of, and you come up with answers like quarks and quantum theory and things that are, you know, totally off the map, out of just totally counterintuitive, and yet you stick to it, well, you're probably looking objective truth right in the face.
Yes.
And on the other hand, you have a scientist of equal credential in a different field, a biologist who is sitting in front of a congressional committee who's been working on a foundation grant from somebody for 15 years of a long career, you're looking at a person who has a great deal of personal career invested in giving the right answer for whatever the policy is of whoever's giving him the money. And in other words, you find the same accusations are true about the bias of scientists in, let's say, the field of environmental foundations, as you would have of, oh, well, that's an industry scientist, let's say, of a pharmaceutical company. You can't trust the industry scientist. Well, that's because they're trying to make policy, why people perceive that. Now, they may be out there discovering objective truth by the barrelful, but that never enters into the final equation all by itself. It always has some conclusion of, well, here's the objective truth. We found 5 kilograms of such and such in this animal. Okay, that's science, that's objective truth. And anybody can go out and find 5 kilograms of whatever it was in that particular organism. No matter how they do it, as long as they follow the procedure, they'll find the same answer. That's objective truth. Now you get in front of Congress, whoever just gets up there and says, well, there's 5 kilograms of such and such in this, and it shuts up. They don't stop there. What they do is they say, and we ought to do this about it. And that's where the objective truth departs. That when you have a scientist that's making recommendations for public policy, put your skepticism hat on very carefully, because what you're probably looking at is something that started out as objective truth but ended up as a policy recommendation, and policy by definition is politics.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Nathan?
Well, yes, it does. But it seems to me that the Founding Fathers definitely believed in the concept of objective truth, and that majority rule can't define it, but that it's transcendent and ultimately derives from God, as they understood God.
Well, it's just an old saying that figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
Well, I can understand what your guest is saying, too. I guess it just sort of leaped out of me. I'm glad he corrected me. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Nathan. And, of course, the tragedy is that, the old saying, he who pays the piper calls the tune. If you're working, a scientist working for government, you better not come out and say that we totally disagree with government policy. If you do, you're not going to have a job. And the same thing happens if you are a scientist working at a university on a large grant from a major pharmaceutical company, or doesn't matter what the company is. But if they're paying your fee, why, and you come up with a conclusion from your scientific study that is not favorable to them, you're never going to get another grant for study from them. That's the objective truth of the whole thing. And, of course, unfortunately, human beings being certainly subject to pressure and being fallible, why, of course, many times scientists will shade what they say or at least influence their conclusions. Maybe the scientific facts are the same, but the conclusions based upon those facts will certainly reflect what is best for the individual rather than his total dedication to the truth. Science is absolute, looking for truth, search for truth and facts, but unfortunately in a corrupt society, many times truth is corrupted. Would that be a fair statement?
I think so. And your caller, Nathan, really brought up an excellent point, and I'm glad he did, because I certainly didn't in any way want to give any kind of hint that I might think that there was no such thing as objective truth. I most certainly do. And I think that with our founding fathers, I agree that it is transcendent and is not subject to majority rule. Public policy, on the other hand, is not transcendent, and it is subject to majority rule. And where you try to bring the two together is where the real problem is, which is why I say that a call for sound science, even though that sounds like you're asking for objective truth, let me tell you how the lawyers that I first dealt with years ago solved the problem of this two scientists in the same courtroom coming up with diametrically opposite conclusions about the same basic data. The basic data they found was discovered in the process of searching for objective truth, and it was objective truth. But scientists have recognized this for a long time. Science isn't just finding the data, it's trying to explain it. Now, they call that a hypothesis. In other words, it's an educated guess as to why. And then what you do in the process of science is to test that hypothesis by finding other experiments or other situations and see if the same thing keeps happening. And presumably there will come a point where your hypothesis really can't explain new information that's found out. So it's sort of set to the side, or it's advanced to more of a scientific law or something like that, like the law of gravity, until something big like Einstein's relativity theory comes along and the whole notion of gravity has to be rethought, and then quantum theory comes along and even Einstein's theory of gravity has to be rethought. The point is not so much what the information is, it's the process. And that is that science, like all search for objective truth, is an open-ended process that doesn't ever have a definite end point where we can say, well, now we have finally found out something that we'll never find out more about. This is all there is to know about that. So this is the objective truth. Well, no, we just keep finding that. We're not so hot about finding objective truth, so we find it in pieces and try to put the pieces together to form a big picture. Sometimes our piecing together is pretty good, and we discover new things, and we find out a lot about objective truth that's both very useful and very inspiring. But usually we find, well, we didn't really quite cover the whole thing. So we keep looking. So the search does look like it's indefinitely long and is open-ended. It's not something that you can say, we found out all about it. And that's something to keep in mind when you have a scientist saying, oh, we know, we have proven, and then fill in the blank with whatever policy they want to impose upon you. Well, science doesn't really prove things as much as it disproves things. The whole process is actually designed to test a theory and see if you can disprove it. So, and if I don't know how many scientists you actually know personally, but if you ever get, it's kind of like the old joke about economists, if you lined up 100 economists in a row, they'd all point in different directions. Well, there's something about scientists that's much the same way. There's, you take any field, whether it's sociology or atomic physics, there will be a group over here that agrees with Professor so-and-so that it's this way, and another group that agrees, no, it's actually Professor B, and it's really that way. So it's a matter of, to make sound policy, you really need to keep in mind it's a political decision, and the policy decision should have as much objective truth in it as you can get, but because there are people who have different views of what that objective truth may be or want to interpret it very differently, you'd better have a spectrum in front of you instead of just, oh, this is the sound science on it, and there is no other sound science. Anybody who tells me that, I become a little suspicious of, that there's only one viewpoint about things, because I do know a lot of scientists, and in trying to do the research that I do, I've had to talk to a lot of them to try to figure out what's really going on. And as a matter of, if you get a big enough spectrum, you can begin to see the terrain more clearly of viewpoints on what any issue has to offer, and then you can make a politically informed and a scientifically informed decision and hope that that's best for public policy.
Well, of course, the tragedy is, of course, public policy is so many times influenced by other people who have the most money. Certainly this thing on the global warming, the administration was able to get about 2,500 scientists, most of whom are not atmospheric scientists, to sign a petition saying global warming was a real factor, and it was caused by, of course, CO2 and man's activity. And, of course, our good friend Dr. Art Robinson was able to circulate a petition and get 17,000 scientists, most of whom were certainly understood the issues, to say that there is absolutely no evidence to go along to verify what the government's trying to convince us of, because basically this whole issue of global warming is an attack on Western civilization and our country specifically, and if the Kyoto Protocol were enforced, why would mean the deindustrialization of the United States? And certainly we see, of course, that this is carrying out a policy that was laid out back in 1972, put forward by the Club of Rome in their program, The Limits of Growth. I'm sure you're well acquainted with that.
Right. The Limits to Growth was one, the first of several Club of Rome policy manuals is about what it was. That first one was written by Donella Meadows, who's actually a distinguished scientist, and I believe she passed away some time ago. I hope I'm wrong about that, but I seem to have that in the back of my mind, that taught up, I believe, at Dartmouth in the Northeast, in New England, and came up with a number of things, but we found that Julian Simon, who was an equally good professor, said, no, wait a minute, you know, none of these things you're talking about comes out to be true, and a whole storm of scientists who were more or less of a like mind with Donella Meadows, that there are limits to growth and that there, all of these terrible things are going to happen, especially Paul Ehrlich, got into a quarrel with Julian Simon about that everything was going to become more scarce and we'd use everything up, and within 20 years or 50 years or some number of years, there wouldn't be any of the stuff left. And, of course, they agreed that, well, price is a good indicator of scarcity. And so they made a bet. Julian Simon bet, I forget what it was, some trivial amount, $10 or something like that, to Paul Ehrlich, that the price of some metal, I believe it was copper or silver or some, you know, some ordinary industrial-type metal, would remain the same or go down. And Ehrlich said, oh, no, it's going to go way up because the supply will vanish. You know, we'll use it all up and it won't be there. Well, as a matter of fact, when it finally, the time elapsed, the price had gone down. And, of course, much to the distress of investors in that metal and people who thought they were so hot in the cornering the silver market and things like that. But I think a lot of people just take these warnings, these dire warnings to heart and ignore the good news. In a way, that's kind of human nature. If somebody says there's a threat, well, you better do something about that. But if somebody says, oh, Flight 102 got there on time and it did not crash, well, you don't need to do anything about that. So the good news goes ignored and the bad news gets all of the headlines.
Well, I think, of course, the whole idea, of course, the Club of Rome and their Limits of Growth report was that we had to drastically alter a life in the Western civilization. We had to drive the prices of gasoline up so that people wouldn't actually use so much gasoline. We would have to begin to lower living standards. We would have to be able to control the growth of the population and reduce it dramatically. And even if we did reduce it dramatically, of course, we would have to lower living standards to that of the people living in Eastern Europe. So there seems to be an organized effort to accomplish this. We see, of course, you know, instead of trying to come up with alternative energy sources, and I'm talking about nuclear energy, that has been consistently blocked at every turn, of course, so we continue to use oil. And instead of doing what's logical, we're doing everything illogically, because these people really believe that only by collapsing civilization can we survive as a race. Have you run into people who feel that way?
Well, as a matter of fact, I have. There was a time in my earlier career where I was intent on getting at the motives of environmentalism. That's where I came up with this comment that it's not solid like a potato. It's more woven like a richly textured fabric with all different kinds of fabrics in it. It's almost like a tapestry.
A tapestry is a good term.
Because it's interwoven with this kind of group and that kind of group. So in interviewing the people who had talked to me, and by that time I had gained something of a reputation as being the devil incarnate to some of these people, because people... I've developed a certain following that agreed with the idea that you should be skeptical about these kind of things when you heard them, and that was not something they appreciated. So some of them wouldn't talk to me. The ones that did, and the ones that wouldn't, I was able to find enough of their own written materials to get at what are the more and more fundamental beliefs of the people who are really trying to stop this kind of growth, and I was able to sort them into some rough categories that actually most of the environmentalists who've had the courtesy of even responding to it have said, well, yes, that's pretty close. It comes down to, well, you start with, I'm just against urban sprawl or something that's reasonably popular and doesn't sound too terribly awful. And then you find out, well, no, underlying that is I just don't like big corporations. I just don't like capitalism. And then you get to the one that is really such a leap that you can't quite wrap your mind around it at first, and that is, no, I don't like human beings. Well, you are a human being. What are you telling me? Well, you get these people like David Graeber of the National Park Service who wrote a piece in the Los Angeles Times saying that human beings are a cancer on the earth, repeating something. I don't know how many environmentalists have written that sentence. Human beings are a cancer on the earth. We're growing too fast. We're going to consume everything, and
we can only wait for the right virus to come along. I think it was just
You have a good memory, Dr. Stan. I really had to hand it to you. That's exactly what Mr. Graeber said, and you look at that and you think, holy cow! I mean, does he really believe that? Well, I contacted him, and he was quite sincere. I mean, the guy just really was what you would have to call anti-human, and in trying to understand that, I called upon a number of different kind of people, and surprisingly, I got the most reasonable answer that even a lot of environmentalists agreed with from a historian, actually a number of historians, who said, well, look, you're looking at something that attitude's been around for a long time, and that is an attitude that things were better the simpler they were, like in, let's say, tribal times are better than complicated civilization, or the Stone Age was better than the Iron Age, or some kind of thing like that, that a simpler life was a better life. And it is astounding how many people have that feeling, especially the ones escaping the rat race in some big city, want to get out to the countryside and live a nice life that isn't full of hustle and bustle and noise and smoke and smog and noise, everything like that. Okay, a lot of people can understand that a simpler life is a better life. And the other one is that the earlier in time, the better it was. Like if you go back a long, long time ago, people were purer, people were better. And those two kind of beliefs have a name among historians. They call it primitivism. And that means not so much that you are primitive or anything like that, but a belief that simpler is better or earlier is better. And that actually got from a number of some pretty sharp-tongued opponents who've raked me over the coals many times in print, said, well, you know, I think he got it right. That really, even though perhaps we don't like the way he puts it, that really does reflect our feelings, that a simpler life is a better life. And, of course, when you get down to the simplest life, it's there's no human beings at all. Like you get these ridiculous, well, I don't know how ridiculous they are, but with the Earth Liberation Front burning apartment complexes down in San Diego at $50 million a crack. But people who, like David Foreman, who started this probably tongue-in-cheek outfit called the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement, In other words, let's get rid of all the humans, and that is the simplest life you can have, no human life at all. So, like I say, it's more like a tapestry. It has a lot of threads in it, and no one can speak for the whole environmental movement any more than any one person could speak for every viewpoint. So it's a matter of understanding where are the major threads in the tapestry, who are the most visible actors in the scene, and who's behind the most visible actors, and understand how the tapestry really works. What does the backside of the tapestry look like? And that's what I've tried to find out. And I find out that it's mostly big money foundations that came from some businessman from years ago. And under the law, charitable giving law in the United States, if you have, let's say, an initial gift of stock, the IRS requires that if you give, let's say, old John D. Rockefeller, and you give a gift of X number of shares of Standard Oil to start the Rockefeller Foundation. Well, nowadays, to do that, you have only 15 years to get rid of all of that initial stock and buy other kinds of investments to keep your endowment legal.
Now, of course, did the Ford Foundation still have Ford stock?
No, it does not. And there's nobody... No. And there's a great confusion that people have. The Ford Foundation was originally started by Henry Ford II and Edsel Ford. And Henry II died. And then Edsel Ford found out that he really was just sitting on the board with almost no power. And the professional managers, the hired staff, were making all the decisions, and they were giving money to things that he just absolutely hated. He didn't want the money going to all of these radical kind of causes that the Ford Foundation was giving money to, so he wrote this scathing letter of resignation in which he just raked them over the coals, saying, look, I earned this money. My father and his father before him earned all this money by hard work and sweat and good marketing, giving people what they wanted. How do you think we got this money to begin with? And all you guys are doing is giving it to people who are trying to tear all that down, and that's not right. I quit. Well, okay, but that shows you how powerless even the wealthy donor was once it got into the bureaucracy of the nonprofit world, where the donor really no longer has much to say about it, and especially if you've got the second and third generation of the donors. The family may still be there, and they may think they're calling the shots, but the farther you go on in time, the more heirs there are. They have kids, and more people have fractions of the original wealth, and maybe they're pretty good at building the wealth themselves. So you get things like, not so much in the Ford family, but because they only had one foundation, but the Rockefellers have, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 different foundations that one or another of them has money in. And if you take a look at the Rockefeller Foundation, that was the first one that old John D. started. It's done some really good things, like it sponsored the Green Revolution, wheat to feed the world, and it eliminated hookworm in the southern United States. Well, you know, who can argue with that? That's good stuff. But you get the second generation after that, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, well, they were actually the third generation. They were the grandsons and one granddaughter of old John D. The Rockefeller Brothers Fund, holy cow, almost all they do is give money to tear down free enterprise, and then you get the fourth generation, the Rockefeller Family Fund, and they're so bad. I mean, you look at it and you think, what in the world do you guys have in mind? You know, you're destroying everything that made your money possible. And they say, yep, that's what we've got in mind.
Well, of course, I'm sure you've read the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report that came out of the Second Earth Summit. And, of course, that is the most incredible, incredible document, because they really want to, of course, get back to the way it was when the Indians were here, and, of course, to do away with the industrialized civilization altogether.
Well, actually, that's really what they had in mind. And, again, you have a fairly small clique of people who believe that. There are even people in the environmental movement who think, oh, now that's too extreme, but there's another clique that thinks, oh, that's not extreme enough, that removing industrial civilization is not good enough. We have to eliminate all humans on the one side of it, and others saying, well, whoa, wait a minute, you know, we We like our fine wines and we like electric lights, and let's not get too carried away with this. So that you have to understand that the tapestry of environmentalism has all of these viewpoints in it, but all of them have some intention to... You can read all of these things as if they were deliberate efforts to remove the United States from any position of power, and only the United States, because how many times do you see France under attack for its way of living? Well, not very often. But the United States, because we're the only superpower left, because we are a wealthy nation, that we have great ambitions, we have the promise of a great achievement and the freedom to rise to our level of ability, and things that you don't have in socialist countries, we're envied. And I think that it's largely envy that makes all of these highly detailed policies that sound so rational and so on, coming from scientists who say, well, we really need to eliminate industrial civilization. No, they're saying we just don't like the United States, really, in their hearts. And if you get them with a, you know, have a few beers with them in the bar after the big public meetings in front of the microphones in Rio, you find out that they're pretty freely able to talk about that. They don't make any big secret of it. But there's others that truly, truly believe that's the only way to save the Earth. And those are the ones, to tell you the truth, I worry more about the true believers than I do about the hypocrites that are just saying that to get attention. And there are quite a few of those. But the ones who truly believe that, like Doug Tompkins, of whose money went to form the Foundation for Deep Ecology, they're the ones that are truly dangerous, because they've got the money to make really, really far-reaching policies, and they have the international reach to empower groups that may have some kind of global government or something else like that in mind. Ultimately, though, in their deepest heart of hearts, they just don't like people, and that's just the most incomprehensible thing for somebody who's reasonably sociable to grasp. If you like people, trying to understand somebody that just doesn't like people at all is really tough.
Well, let me just quote here briefly from David Foreman. I just came across this.
Sure.
My three main goals would be, and I'm quoting from Holly Swanson's book, because she's quoting him. David Foreman, who created Earth First, said, my three main goals would be to reduce human population to about 100 million worldwide, destroy the infrastructure and sea wilderness with its full component of species returning throughout the world. AIDS is not a malediction, but the welcome and natural remedy to reduce the population of the planet. Should human beings disappear, I surely wouldn't mind. Would he qualify for one of the people you find it difficult to understand?
Well, in a way, yes, and in a way, no. You have to understand that he said all of that after he was convicted in a felony case by the FBI. In a sting operation for trying to blow up five nuclear power plants in the American Southwest.
Yeah, but of course, what was his punishment? He was given probation.
Well, no, you need to understand this more carefully. It's very detailed. He was required, because he entered a guilty plea, he had to sign two guilty pleas at the same time. One to a felony, and that is conspiracy, to blow up nuclear power plants, and the other one was a misdemeanor of depredating government property. And here are the conditions, and that's what has to do with this statement that Holly quoted in her book. The deal was, okay, if you can keep your nose clean, Mr. Foreman, for 5 years, said the prosecutor, we will then tear up this felony conviction, and you will then have to go address a court as to what penalty you're going to end up paying for this misdemeanor conviction. But that means you won't have anything to do with Earth First or this other eco-terror group, that you will be, you can say anything you want. You know, you can't advocate
violence.
I'm sorry, Dr. Stan, but it's just a matter that, yeah,
Hello, Ron?